Hello and welcome to History in Reverse, a father-daughter science fiction podcast. Today we will be discussing the dystopias that we've read over the past year and comparing and analyzing them. Hello and welcome to History in Reverse. My name is Caroline. I'm here with my father, Richie.
Hi.
Hi. And we're going to be discussing today the dystopias that we've been reading over the past year or so. And we've read a good handful of them at this point.
We've read some classics and some new things.
Mm-hmm. You made me read some Lem.
Naturally.
So just to recap, we read Brave New World, 1984. Return from the Stars, The Hunger Games, just the first book, The Handmaid's Tale, and two short stories, Omelas by Ursula Le Guin, and Truth of Fact, Truth of Fiction by Ted Chiang.
Truth of Feeling.
And if anyone wants to hear more details about those specific stories, check out the podcasts in the feed before this, because we did do a podcast on each of them individually. So what we're going to do today is similar to what we did for our Alien stories. We're going to go over the dystopias we read and sort of talk about dystopias, utopias, and compare them and analyze them, talk about themes and all kinds of fun stuff. So, are you excited, Dad?
Yes, I'm very excited. So, I think, you know, we invented this dystopia scale.
Mm-hmm.
You know, on one end is 1984, and then the other end is Brave New World.
Mm-hmm.
And we can discuss how they're different. And then I think we discovered there was more to this scale than just those two, because some dystopias have to do with technology, not so much. There's like, you know, I guess some dystopias have to do with politics and setting up the government, maybe being repressive or society being repressive. So that's one. And the other one is technology appearing, mm-hmm. and changing people's lives in bad or good way.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So there's a lot of different things that are shared among these stories. So I think, I mean, maybe we can start broadly with, you know, what, now having read a bunch of this, what would be qualified as dystopias, what is a dystopia? What is a utopia? At least when it comes to science fiction. You know, I think that, like we see in these stories, kind of like what you're talking about, a dystopia is a world the author creates where things are not good for a variety of reasons. And sometimes it's not that they're not good for everybody, but sometimes they're not good just for the characters or just for some of the characters,
right,
within the story. And it generally has to do not just with, like, that character's having a bad day, but, like, there's some kind of system, or whether it's a political system or a technology system,
right,
in place that is causing the character to be living a dystopic life.
Well, unhappy life, I suppose, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think so. What I find really interesting is actually the technology difference. So actually, since we talked about that, let's just start there. Because I do think when we think of dystopias, for the most part, we think about things like 1984 and Brave New World, where it's the society, the structure of the society that's oppressive in some way or another, right?
That's true, so, but in Brave New World, actually, there's technologies in both, right? So in 1984, there was this technology that watched everybody. So mm-hmm. Big Brother always knew what you were doing, to the point mm-hmm. where you could not hide pretty much anything.
Right, but I think that there's a difference. So for example, in 1984 and Brave New World, you have stories where the dystopia aspect comes from the society. In 1984, it's just very oppressive. The technology isn't special. It's technology
true,
we have,
true.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Brave New World technology is maybe a little bit more specialized. We don't necessarily have everything in Brave New World.
But
that's all.
Well, but
luxurious.
I mean, in Brave New World, the technology of reproduction was kind of important to reforming the society, right? So no longer mm-hmm. there are parents. You know, mother is a dirty word.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the M word. You know, people go around saying the M word, and that's really mm-hmm. bad.
So would you consider that a I guess in my mind, that would still be kind of a more cultural dystopia, as in comparison to something like Return from the Stars is the story that I think is kind of the standout in our list. That,
right,
and Truth of Fact, Truth of Feeling, the short story by Ted Chiang. Those two stories really focus on the fact that the discomfort is coming from the technology that cannot be avoided. And it's like the technology that's producing the main character's difficulty, as opposed to the society that happens to be taking advantage of a technology that is producing the main character's discomfort. Kind of, does that make sense?
Sort of. You can also think about which came first. Like, you know, mm-hmm. in Brave New World, the technology was kind of invented to form the society, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because they allude to some previous wars or some bad things happening. They decided to use technology to stratify people into these classes, so I was very happy in a place in life, and that's mm-hmm. why the technology came along. Whereas in Return from the Stars, because, you know, the world just evolves into the future, and this guy from the past shows up, and he just doesn't fit. Because mm-hmm. One of the reasons is the technology kind of prevents him from doing the stuff that kind of makes him him.
Right, exactly. But I think that's the difference. I think that what you just described is precisely the difference between these kind of more common cultural dystopias and then what seems to be the rarer technology dystopias. And Truth of Fact, Truth of Feeling fits into that latter category as
right.
well, because it's not that society is trying to watch you exactly, it's that this technology has become widely used and the main character is uncomfortable with it for a variety
right.
of reasons.
And because it changes the way you think, right? So
right.
the technology in that story, if you didn't read it, is writing. So
mm-hmm.
you know, the main character lives in the oral culture and then writing is introduced and we see what interesting things happen.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So I think that it's really interesting to think about the dystopias both on kind of the spectrum, 1984 to Brave New World, and also within these categories of whether it's cultural or whether it's technological. And I think, so I kind of two points on that. The first being, I think that also helps us get to the question of what is science fiction, which is something we've talked about before. Because Handmaid's Tale, why is Handmaid's Tale a science fiction story? There is no
science.
Right? There's no technology that's fancy. There's no, you know, there's nothing that would normally mark it as a science fiction story, but I think we're all in agreement, even if the author is not necessarily, I think everyone else is in agreement,
right.
that it's a science fiction story.
Maybe part of it is it's kind of implied that it happens in the future.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I definitely think that's part of it. But I think it's because it is a dystopia that falls into that cultural dystopia
right.
category.
Right. And because of the main character, you know, we just see the world through her eyes and she doesn't know that much. She's on purpose being kept uninformed. So we just kind of have to deduce what might be happening based on what she sees and what she might know
mm-hmm.
without
mm-hmm.
really knowing much of the history or, you know.
And then the other thing that I'm interested in is we're kind of talking about the spectrum of Brave New World in 1984. Do you want to explain what we mean when we talk about that spectrum?
Well, 1984 is obvious dystopia where there's very repressive government and people are pretty miserable living under this government. Maybe they pretend a little bit that that it's okay, but basically everybody is kind of, I don't know, sad, you know,
mm-hmm.
given up or whatever. It's like George Orwell wrote this book in 1948, which is why he called it 1984. Did you know that?
Oh, no, I did not. That's cute.
And he describes the way he describes the world there. It's in London, right, where most of the action occurs.
Mm-hmm.
And he describes basically wartime London, where there were rationing and shortages and bombs kept falling and things like that. So he kind of riffs on that. Whereas something like Brave New World, it really describes kind of like a paradise and
mm-hmm.
in a way, right? It's, why is it dystopia? You get whatever you want. You whatever you do, you're happy with, right? Because you
mm-hmm.
were essentially bred to be happy in your position. You have fun. You can go play, you know, three-dimensional tennis or whatever. Whatever the sports he invented there.
Mm-hmm.
And but I think from our point of view, the reason we think it's a dystopia is because it kind of, they try to suppress what we would consider these very human characteristics, like you know, being creative, being maybe sometimes miserable, maybe trying something different, or not always be comfortable, right?
Mm-hmm.
And both Brave New World in 1984, I guess Brave New World probably more, and Handmaid's Tale as well, and to some degree Return from the Stars, they all have a lot of sex in them.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So Brave New World, it's all sex is just funsies, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so they kind of strip all the emotional stuff from it. It's just like, you know, having ice cream or something.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And mm-hmm. In 1984, it's the reverse. It's sex is just that to procreate, it's a job.
Right.
Right. And
oh, that's interesting. And they're kind of on opposite ends of this, of our
right.
Soul
but
spectrum,
again, and the emotion is kind of removed from it. Like, in Winston, his wife was, you know, left him because he failed on his job.
Right. What did she say? That we have to do our duty for the party.
Right. Right.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. No,
and that's similar to Handmaid's Tale, right?
That is very similar to Handmaid's Tale. So I'm wondering if we should just go through the stories and put them on the scale and see what we think. So if we got 1984 as our base.
Right.
Next in line would, my guess would be Handmaid's Tale.
Either right, you're right, because Hunger Games. It's, but there's no sex in Hunger Games, really.
Well, I mean, we're not by, we don't have to do it by a sex scale, but by a
right.
dystopia
by
scale.
Dystopia scale. You. Yeah, I would say Handmaid's Tale is in that corner, right, because mm-hmm. it's a very uncomfortable life. There's a war going on, that they're fighting Baptists or something.
Yeah, exactly.
And the same thing in 1984, right? There was a war that explained everything. You know, there are shortages. We can't produce stuff because we've been at war with Oceania. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I think the difference why I would say 1984 is closer to the 1984 end of the spectrum, besides that it is our marker for the end of the spectrum, is that the endings. Think about the way that the two stories end. You know, Winston Smith is killed at the end of 1984.
Right.
And
well,
he's
not so much killed as his soul
is
killed.
It's a metaphor. It's a metaphor.
Right.
The Big Brother wins, right? That's the
Big
idea.
Big Brother wins. Winston's soul is basically dead. He gives up. So.
Right. And Handmaid's Tale, the ending presumably is that the handmaid at least escapes the initial house she was in.
Right.
If not ultimately escaping
And we disagree about whether she escaped or not, but
right. Exactly. But she at least escapes the initial home of oppression, I suppose.
Right, right.
So that's why I put Handmaid's Tale a little bit more, it's a ever so slightly more utopia.
Right.
Than 1984.
it's a little bit nicer, a little bit
yeah.
of a hopeful ending, whereas the 1984 is just crushed. The hero mm-hmm. gets crushed and that's it.
So then I think the next logical one would be Hunger Games.
Okay, right.
And that's because it's still usually this very oppressive government, but it's clear from the jump, you know, with Katniss that the people do a lot to get around it. You know,
right.
They go, she can go hunt and they can... They can choose a lot of things in their lives. They can kind of choose where they're living. I mean, the things that are keeping them controlled is pretty much like poverty and
right.
like
right.
the police state, but it's not so intense as
right.
as the other ones.
And
so
the
I
game
would say,
games are kind of weird entertainment kind of mm-hmm. a thing.
These all kind of have a similarity to in the limiting of information and how information is disseminated or not disseminated.
Right.
So that seems to be a theme throughout all the stories is how information is transferred or not transferred. And then after that, I'm not sure.
Well, I think Return from the Stars mm-hmm. is much closer to Brave New World, right? So you have this mm-hmm. world that, if you're from that time, everything is kind of nice and comfy. You know, they have this device that you can't get hurt. You know, if you drive too fast and you crash into something, mm-hmm. it's just nothing happens. From the point, so the in the story, the astronaut Hal Bragg, who's the hero of the story, comes back from a trip in outer space, which is full of dangers and crazy adventures, and he comes back into, because of time dilation, 200 years into the future, and he discovers that, you know, the stuff that was most important to him, meaning space travel and exploration, nobody cares.
Mm-hmm.
So nobody cares because, you know, they can have, you know, essentially like a holodeck. experiences. Mm-hmm. But safe, you know, everybody's safe. Nothing bad happens. It's just mm-hmm. a little game. And everybody's kind of passive. And he doesn't quite fit. Like, you know, you can't even hit people because they just, you know, they killed all the sports that involve fighting.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, I think that would make sense next, because it's sort of like...
It's like he's John Savage.
Right, exactly. But it's not, we're not quite at Brave New World level.
Right.
With the
and the thing about that book, the thing about Return from the Stars is that I read it several times, but I remembered the ending incorrectly.
Oh, so interesting.
I always thought that he decided in the end to go back. So he has a friend, Olaf, right, who mm-hmm. is in the same boat as him. And they just, Olaf and a bunch of people decide that they can't stay here. They're going to go explore the cosmos some more. And mm-hmm. they invite him to go. And I thought that he went, and he, when I reread it last time, it seems to me that he didn't.
Yeah, no, I don't think he does. That's interesting. You need to get one of those implants or whatever from a... Truth of fact, truth of feeling.
Right.
No, I think that makes sense for Return from the Stars. I'm kind of wondering, so I feel like 1984, Handmaid's Tale, and The Hunger Games are kind of on the, you know, more dystopic
right.
side of the spectrum. And then Return from the Stars is our first one that kind of steps into the utopic half of the spectrum. And I'm wondering why that is. And I mean, I think it's because the, you know, society is so safe and everything, but it's not as... I guess part of the issue with utopia is that it begins to become forced at a certain point, and that's kind of where we're heading towards the Brave New World, that it becomes a controlled happiness as opposed to Return from the Stars. Return from the Stars sounds kind of like what might actually happen in history, where things just become safer and more fun and, you know,
and
nicer.
That's how it's been. It's becoming more safer and more fun than it used to be.
Right.
You know, we always talk about in the time of American Revolution, you're reading, mm-hmm. you could take your gun and go into the wilderness and just come back 3 months later and be fine, but you'd be completely free, not encumbered by any societal rules or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And it's probably harder also, maybe more difficult to survive or something, but
mm-hmm.
it's a challenge. So
right, exactly.
I'm wondering if somebody from 200 years ago came to our time, you know, what would they think? So it'd be all kinds of amazing and confusing things.
Mm-hmm.
But then he would probably feel that you know, we've become very soft, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure whatever like job
nobody can even ride a horse, you know.
Right. I'm sure whatever job someone had 200 years ago is probably now like an automated factory thing.
Well, it depends what you were doing. So, like, you know, if you were
right.
a writer, you were a writer, but.
Yeah, definitely. So then there's Return of the Stars, and then I guess the next one would be Truth of Fact, Truth of Feeling.
Right, it's also a similar thing with...
Yeah, where it's like, you know, the society is pretty realistic and everything, and then there's this technology. Then I would say Omelas, and then Brave New World.
Right, Omelas almost stands like a little bit to a side, because it's like a fable.
It's like a thought experiment. It's kind of like... I think Omelas is almost like a very, very, very watered-down version of Brave New World. It's like it kind of gets at the main gist of it, which is the point, you know, when you talk about dystopias and utopias, is that one can't exist without the other. So you can't have something that's just a dystopia, and you can't have something that's just a utopia. And that's kind of what Omelas is in metaphor.
I don't know. 1984 seems pretty dystopic to me. There is no utopia about it.
Not that we know of, but we don't know anything about the inner party. You know, assumedly, and I think it's fair to assume in 1984 that the government isn't run like that so that everyone can be miserable. Somebody's running it. And
somebody who's running could be miserable. But
certainly someone whoever's running it is reaping some kind of benefit from it. Because they wouldn't, a regular human wouldn't,
I guess,
form a horrible government to also suffer in it. If they had all the power, they would do something to benefit themselves. It sounds like that's what the inner party does.
Right.
So, you know, I think it's really interesting because, you know, on this kind of scale, no matter where you go on the scale, there's the presence of both dystopic and utopic aspects, right?
Right. So yeah, I started to think about, you know, what the difference is between utopia and dystopia. And I guess, a utopia is when everything is kind of good, but it's very constant. Nothing is really changing. And I think in general, humans would not deal very well with that. When everything is just also peachy, you get bored, right? So I was thinking, like Star Trek is kind of a utopia, right?
Oh, definitely. It's the Earth of Star Trek's universe is very utopic.
Right. But this cruise ship, the crew of Starship Enterprise has all kinds of crazy adventures because they're explorers. So some of the stuff they have to deal with is not utopian at all, right? So.
Well, that's how they get away with it. They you know, Earth itself, like if we were watching the people of Star Trek just on Earth, it would be super boring. I mean, like, they don't even get paid. They don't have money anymore on Earth.
Well, who needs the money?
What are they doing all this hard stuff for? There's no money. Like, it's very hard to motivate people. I mean, it's certainly possible.
Well,
it's kind of like they do this backdrop of this kind of vague sort of utopia specifically so that they can go explore other worlds and kind of be judgmental about it, right? So it's very easy to tell the audience, you know, racism is bad when the race you're talking about is a race where some of the people are literally painted half white and half black, and the other people are also painted half white and half black, but in the opposite pattern.
Right.
And there's racism between them. It's very easy to feed that to an audience and say, look, this is stupid. Like, obviously, that's stupid. Racism is bad. It's much harder to do that when you use actual races your audience is actually familiar with.
Yeah.
So, but Star Trek definitely has a utopia backdrop.
Right.
You said something interesting. Oh, you're talking about stasis. Yeah, so I'm really interested in this. I saw this in your notes. Stasis versus change.
Right, so basically, when things don't change, they become boring. People don't deal with stuff being very stasis, very the same. So, like, that was part of Brave New World, right? The people who were uncomfortable in that world were people who kind of wanted to think and feel different things, not just the be happy, happy, happy all the time, right? And I think there's a Chinese saying that you cannot appreciate sweet until you taste bitter. Right. So
absolutely,
it's the same kind of thing.
I think what's really interesting about this concept is, along with stasis and change, is like the fact that human beings particularly seek out challenges to the point where we create challenges for ourselves. You know, we create games, you know, just to have like a set of rules and now play. And you know, feel accomplished when you win with the arbitrary rules you've created in the fake game you've created. You know, it's like very. I think that people need, like you were saying, people need to feel challenged because they need to feel accomplishment.
And well, it's human nature. I don't know. You know, in the past, in Darwin's theory of evolution, he talks about struggle for existence. Right. So, you know, the. Whatever organism survives is the one that somehow does something better or whatever. So, and they have to, you know, humans can change their environment that they're living in, not just adapt to it by change it.
So I think, we're sort of hitting on two different things. So when it comes to stasis and change, I have a question for you though. So we look at something like Brave New World, and I think we can pretty easily see that part of the utopia is that, you know, everything is safe and fun and everyone's healthy.
Remember Mustafa Mann said stability, 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 right? That was the goal of the society.
Right. So, and I think we as readers can read that and kind of be abhorred by it and say like, oh God, that seems so boring. That seems, you know, awful in a lot of ways because of the fact that there is no change and just stability is boring and isn't challenging to us. On the opposite end of our spectrum, in 1984, Winston doesn't like his stability, but certainly has it, right?
Right, right. So I see what you're saying. So stability is part... Well, I think when I was thinking, now that we're talking about it, the extreme dystopia, extreme utopia are kind of the same, like the very static and the same. You know, this is really, really bad, and that's how it is, and you can't change it. And it's really, really good. And that's how it is, deal with it, right? And the characters that, you know, appear in these books, they want to do slightly different things, right? So Bernard was the one who just felt uneasy in this kind of society where you could, you know, sex was ice cream. He wanted to feel some emotion. He didn't want to have, you know, 50 girls. He wanted to have one.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I guess it kind of comes down to the two ends of the spectrum of the dystopias. I think that they are, I think at some point they roll over. Probably more of a circle than a...
Well, I guess that's something like Brave New World.
Because, I mean, it has to do... It's not... I think that there's a similar element. It's not only like this stability or this staticness and the inability to change it, but also the intense government control and the fact that there's this... There's a reason you can't change it. Like, I imagine in Return to the Stars, if Hal really, really wanted to change something, he probably could, or at least he could make progress towards it, or do something.
Well, he did.
That.
He ripped up the thing from his car so he could crash it.
Right, exactly. You know,
and
he has
his friends could box, but I mean, it was like fighting against a hurricane, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Because,
but still having the ability to fight, right? So there's like very
well. It's
you know,
it's like John Savage, who had the same kind of a thing where he was basically man out of time, right? And once he left the reservation, the things that he thought were valuable or you know, things that he thought were admirable in his world were just silly in the other world, right? So he wanted to date Lenina and kind of keep her on pedestal and have great love and stuff, you know, all the Shakespeare stuff. And she thought that was silly.
Yeah.
But she was attracted to him because he was different from her usual stuff. So she had a little bit of the boredom.
Right, exactly. I wonder if it kind of also is part of like the concept of, like, humans always want what they can't have, right? The kind of
that's
reverse
probably,
psychology.
Yeah.
You know, because that's the kind of thing you're hitting on here too, is that, like, you know, like Bernard wanted, you know, he's surrounded by all this like wondrous freedom and safety, etc., and he could do all these things, but the one thing he wants to do is the one thing he's not supposed to want to do. And Winston Smith has a place to live and food and a job and like all these things that, you know, give him a lot of stability, but all the things he wants are none of those things. I'm just wondering if there's a connection between, you know, wanting to accomplish things and wanting there to be change and a challenge and sort of this desire to, I guess, to earn something, and for lack of a better term, and like having a goal and achieving it, and then, you know, when you're handed something, whether it be in a dystopic or utopic fashion, you know, the rejection of it, basically, because it's not something that you did anything to maintain.
That's probably part of it. So, like, the people have this creative impulse, right? We want to create things.
Mm-hmm.
And even, you know, when you have a hobby and you make something or paint or play music or whatever, it's always more fun when you do it by yourself. So there, you know, people with money can buy all the stuff that's probably made better than would be otherwise, or more professional or whatnot, but still the satisfaction of making something. That was something that struck me actually in Brave New World. Right? There are like two scenes where John Savage, he says the one only time he was happy while he was on a reservation was somebody was teaching him how to make pots from clay.
Mm-hmm.
And he basically got lost in the making. And
right.
And the same thing happened to him when he was in his exile, self-exile at the end, and he was making arrows so he could hunt. And he also fell into this, you know, kind of flow where he was creating the arrows. He just was living in the moment, essentially. And that's why he decided, and he felt happy and he felt really guilty about it. That's why he made the whip, right?
Right. Yeah. I mean, and I guess maybe one of the things that's similar about dystopia and utopia is that they both prevent people, like prevent the characters within their worlds from doing that and from creating, really.
But what did Winston want to create? He didn't want to create anything. He just wanted, he was having an affair with Julia and he was just happy just doing that.
Well, he wasn't even particularly happy doing that, but because he didn't really love Julia. I mean, he acknowledges that in the text. He wanted to bring down Big Brother. He wanted to create a world without Big Brother. So he wanted to destroy the world of Big Brother, and basically wanted to rebel.
He wanted to rebel, and it was,
yeah.
But there was not, you know, what he was trying to rebel against was much more much too powerful for him to rebel against.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah. No, it's definitely interesting to think about, like, what, you know, what, I guess a big part of it is control. And if you look at these stories that we kind of put in the middle of the spectrum, I think the difference between them as opposed to the ends of the spectrum is the amount of agency and control the characters have over their own lives.
Well, the same mm-hmm. in Return from the Stars, right? So Hal rebels. He kidnaps a girl, right? Just mm-hmm. because, you know, he could have asked her and she probably would have said, we'll go. But he did his big man, you know, me Tazza and you Jane kind of a thing.
Yeah.
But he also rebelled in a sense that, you know, he ripped out the safety device out of his car. He got his friend to come down and he wanted to box.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
So, I mean, maybe one of the things that dystopia and utopia both do also is sort of, it sounds like they prevent humans from fulfilling their nature, both in terms of like creating, but also, so in terms of creating, in terms of robbing people of autonomy and choice.
Right. You could say you can, mm-hmm. dystopias take people's freedom.
Right. And but so does utopia.
Right.
You know, they both do.
Right, and which is, I guess, really point, like Brave New World tries to make that point, and so does Return from the Stars. Omelas, not so much. They all do. So, like, I was just thinking, you mentioned rebellion. So in mm-hmm. Hunger Games, the rebellion is at the very end of the story where Katniss decides not, you know, she's not going to kill Peter.
Mm-hmm.
No matter what the rules are, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that's a direct example of... I mean, she's also rebelling throughout the story because she's... But, you know, when she's back living in District 12, she's rebelling by going hunting illegally. She's right. mentally rebelling a lot. There's, like, a lot of active thinking mm-hmm. about rebelling, which is really interesting. I think a lot of these stories, actually, one thing they have in common is that the characters, save for Omelas, which we don't have a first-person point of view in, or a close third person, the characters all think so much. They have so many thoughts, and they think about their circumstances a lot, which I think a lot of fiction doesn't always go into, you know, like they, like, you know, they think about, you know, Winston thinks about Big Brother and the structure of society and stuff like that. And, you know, Katniss is constantly thinking about Pan Am and her feelings about it and things like that.
The handmaid, so what is the rebellion there?
So hers is all like micro-rebellion stuff, right? You know, she...
Well, she participates with the what's his name?
The captain. Was it general or captain? I forget. Captain?
Was it captain?
I forget.
Yeah.
The guy. The man of the house. The man I forget. Of the house, I don't remember right. his hand. I don't remember his name. Yeah, I mean, she participates in some rebellion. I think most of what she does is the sort of passive mental rebellion that the vast majority of people in those right. kind of situations right. need to participate in. You know, most of the time, if you're in an oppressive government, you as an individual can't really do anything, but being aware of the fact that that's what's going on and like retaining a sense of reality is part of rebellion.
Right. Don't let the mm-hmm. bastards grind you down.
Mm-hmm.
Don't
exactly.
let the bastards grind you down. Right.
And that's why 1984's Thought Police is so frightening and
right.
so important, because
right.
that's the exact kind of rebellion that Thought Police are trying to curb.
And they eventually get to Winston, so he gives mm-hmm. up even there, right?
This actually relates sort of, so we talked about stasis and change, this relates pretty well to the idea of the individual versus the collective in terms of dystopia and utopia. And I think that, again, looking at our scale, when you look at the two ends of the spectrum for dystopia and utopia, the overwhelming feeling is that the collective is what matters, not the individual.
Right.
And then when you kind of look at our middler stories, there's more individuality allowed to those characters by their circumstances.
Which ones? Oh, you mean,
so,
well, I guess in Hunger Games, there's more of individual kind of a thing.
Right, so like in 1984, for example, the government's so down everyone's throats that nobody has their own opinions about stuff, right? It's
right.
like they're so controlled, they can't everything. Whereas, you know, your next step up in Handmaid's Tale, the handmaid, at least internally, has her own memories and her own opinions about things. And
right,
you know,
and there's the Handmaid Network where they mm-hmm. kind of pass rumors around, so you kind of sort of know what goes on amongst the handmaids.
Right? Mm-hmm. And then sort of as you get to the other end of it, when you look at like Brave New World, you know, does Lenina really have her own individuality, or is she basically programmed to be how she is? I mean, she's genetically programmed to be as she is.
Well, yes, she's a beta. You know, what did you expect?
Exactly. And that is not for her benefit. It's for society's benefit.
That's an interesting question, you know, of destiny versus, again, individual agency, individual freedom, right?
Mm-hmm. And then I think what's interesting is this is where the short story, Truth of Fact, Truth of Feeling, I think kind of is an interesting juggernaut in this, mm-hmm. not juggernaut, I don't know, it's an interesting pivot kind of in this scale for in this topic, because I think, so that the main character in that story, well, there's two main characters,
two
but
main characters,
the modern, right. The modern day main character, the father, is struggling with this new device that lets you record your entire life and then easily search
right.
all of your recorded memories, right?
Right.
And I think one of the reasons he's struggling with it is that it favors the collective memory of an event, which is whatever the real memory is of it, right? Versus the
whatever
individual's
real
memory.
Means.
Yeah. Versus the individual's memory
right.
of it.
Right.
And I think that that's an example of a technology that is maybe one of the reasons we would consider that story a dystopia or a utopia, is because of the fact that that technology minimizes your feelings about a memory. And basically makes your feelings about memory totally useless.
Right,
right?
Like irrelevant,
the
right.
way,
right.
Yeah, it doesn't matter what you think happened, because we have the actual record of what actually happened. And that's what controls, ultimately. So it's like very much putting down the individual and bolstering the
right.
collective in that way.
Well, in Brave New World, it is stability versus the couple of individuals. So as Bernard, who was the guy who wanted to be a writer, who didn't want to write silly ads?
Oh, I don't remember their names
anymore.
His
name, but
I should have gone back and listened to the podcast.
Again, there's people who want to express the individuality, right? They want to. The guy doesn't want to write ads. He wants to write plays like Shakespeare. Bernard
mm-hmm.
wants to have, you know, be in love with one girl, and mm-hmm. exclusively. And John Savage, you know, has his own savage ways, right?
Yes.
But, they have to
and
be suppressed because they, mm-hmm. the collective is more important in the story. This, you know, stability, stability, stability.
Mm-hmm. And the collective is more powerful. I think that's
well,
kind
I mean,
of the...
Even Mustafa Mann said, you know, he was interested in physics. You know, he was the world controller. And
mm-hmm.
he gave all that up because he wanted to have stability. Right.
Right. Right. And I think one of the things we can pull out from these dystopias and utopias is that the collective will overpower the individual. Maybe that's what makes it a dystopia. That the individuality,
right?
You
the
know,
mob comes after you. Yeah.
Particularly in the West and like in the United States and America, you know, we value individuality so much,
right.
And so these stories about the individual being not only struggling against the collective but like ultimately losing to the collective
right.
are viscerally very difficult, I think, for Western readers. Are these all stories?
Well, so
Western?
Huxley was English, Orwell was English,
mm-hmm.
Lem was Polish, Collins is and Atwood are both American, or Atwood is Canadian, but North America,
mm-hmm.
right? And Le Guin is, and Chang are both Americans. So.
Yeah, so it's like pretty Western. So I wonder if maybe that's kind of, because, you know, we have these stories that are, you know, ones that are clearly dystopia, ones that are kind of more on the utopia
mm-hmm.
side, whatever, but they all kind of have these things, you know. I don't think we would really want to live in the Brave New World Society. I don't think I would want to live in the Brave New World Society. There's a lot of things I like about it.
Well, not being what you are, right? But I mean, that's the whole thing. It's
right. You know, if I had some kind of way to choose, you know, I wouldn't want to be programmed to have a particular destiny. I mean, this is kind of interesting. It kind of gets back to our discussion back when we read The Story of Your Life, also by Ted
mm-hmm.
Chiang, about, you know, autonomy
and destiny,
fate.
Essentially just
destiny,
knowing.
Yeah. Right, exactly. And it's like, it's not fun to know how everything's going to play out. You know, you kind of want to You kind of wanted to surprise you.
Surprised you.
Yeah.
Well, this goes back to my theory of art, remember? Where mm-hmm. art has come, you know, it's you have to have a right balance between what's expected and what's unexpected. Mm-hmm. That's funny, this maps very much into this idea of stasis and change, right? If everything is really expected, it's really boring. It's because, mm-hmm. you know, so it doesn't make interesting art. If it's unexpected, it's also boring because you have no idea what how to interpret it, and you have to kind of balance it in between the two, right? Mm-hmm. So every, you know, if you have a story or a book where the words don't even make sentences, they're just kind of randomly thrown words, nobody's mm-hmm. going to read it, there's nothing.
If so it's like, the Ulysses or something like that.
Right. Well, Ulysses is a little bit, not quite there, but Ulysses actually is meant to be read out loud because it's the Irish accent that
mm-hmm.
that gets you, is what I hear.
But yeah, I mean, I think that's very true. And I think a lot of these kind of scales and this versus that kind of stuff that we're coming up with all kind of relate to each other in that way. So there is one more bit here, and then I want to get to our final question. So mm-hmm. you put in the notes scapegoat versus martyr. And then I thought about it, and I thought I had figured it out, but I'm not 100% sure I have. So what do you mean by scapegoat
versus
martyr?
Right, so this is, we talked about Omelas, right? So mm-hmm. Part of the story of Omelas, that is this one child that suffers terribly in order so that the rest of society can be utopian, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we were saying, you said, well, that's a scapegoat, right? So there's a person who suffers essentially for sins of others. Or to make others' lives better or something. And mm-hmm. we try to decide which one is, what's the difference between that and a martyr. And I think you came up with the observation that a martyr has a choice. So a martyr will choose to mm-hmm. jump into the fire or jump on the grenade or whatever, do something. Mm-hmm. Be himself crucified, let's say. And mm-hmm. Knowing that this will save people and help people, right? So...
Mm-hmm. That's a very smart observation. Definitely sounds like something I said. I just listened to how smart I was in the past because I don't remember that. But I mean, I do think that's true. Yeah. So I guess if you're
so like if you look at our main characters throughout these books, so Wilson wasn't neither, right? I wouldn't call him a martyr or a scapegoat.
I was thinking in 1984 that the other countries were scapegoats. Because of the way they did their propaganda. So I was thinking it more in terms of how it functioned in the story, right. Not as in the individual. So I don't know that, yeah, I agree with you. I don't know that 1984 has
right.
a...
Right, so yeah, you can think, who do you blame for the current situation, right?
Right.
So yeah, what about Katniss?
Katniss volunteers, right? I volunteer right. tribute. So she would fall, I think, more into the martyr category. And if you read the second and third book, which I do not suggest because they're not good, but if you do that... or if you go watch the movies, she definitely becomes a martyr because she becomes like a symbol of the revolution.
Right.
And I do think an aspect of martyrdom would be how you're ultimately viewed, because obviously a martyr is viewed well and a scapegoat is viewed not well.
Right.
But the context of just the first book, if she would have to be a martyr, I think she'd be a martyr.
And Handmaid's Tale, I think she's neither. She kind of sort of escapes it anyway, so.
I think she might become... I mean, I think the difficulty with both scapegoat and martyr is they kind of imply that the person dies, and, like, Katniss doesn't die.
Right.
Though she does almost die a lot. Handmaid's Tale, we don't know if she dies or not. I mean, I could see the handmaid becoming...
But she wasn't doing it to any greater purpose, right? So she was just...
Yeah, she just happened to be in that situation. Yeah. So Omelas would be a scapegoat.
Right.
Right, that child would be a scapegoat. What other stories do we have here? Let's see.
Was the other ones, I don't think it applies, like Return from the Stars.
What about Brave New World, about John Savage dies?
Yeah, he's kind of a martyr figure, right?
Because
mm-hmm. he's one of those people who's out of place, in either mm-hmm. place where he was born, where he lived. On the reservation, and then when he left there, it was other places as well. So he was like in between the world somehow.
Right. Yeah, I can see him on kind of the martyr scale. I don't know that it really applies to Return from the Stars.
Right.
But that's interesting to think about the way that that plays in with these dystopias and utopias. And how common that is, actually, if you're looking at them. How right. often that archetype kind of comes up.
Do we talk about technological dystopias?
We started with that, like the political and the technological.
But so, I don't know if I said it before, but the interesting thing about the technology part is that the effect of technologies can be ambiguous, right? So, like in Return from the Stars, the technologies that he describes are kind of cool. You know, self-driving cars, you know, Amazon store with Kindle. robots everywhere, right? Doing stuff for you so you don't have to do any hard work. Everything is safe, so you don't have to worry about, you know, crashing a car. But then there's this, remember this scene in Return from the Stars in the recycling factory of robots?
Oh my God, it was so creepy.
Yeah.
Ugh.
So the technology, you know, from one hand can be pretty amazing, but on the other hand, it's like it takes away from your ability, I guess, you know, from the humanity of the characters, right? So the characters who lived in that future had adapted and they're fine with it. They moved on kind of beyond that.
Mm-hmm.
But Hal, being the guy from the past, has issues with it.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, I keep trying to imagine what would happen to somebody from 200 years ago, like if Hamilton was alive today. What would he think?
You know? He would just write a lot, but he'd be typing instead of writing. He'd be posting like a lot on Facebook. That's what he would do.
I don't know.
No, I mean, I'm sure there's stuff like that that would be like, I mean, imagine 200 years from now what kind of weird stuff they're going to have if you were popped into that right. world. Like,
but like, you know, to heat your house, you had to like chop wood and stuff. And nowadays you don't do that. So it's like, what if he enjoyed chopping wood?
I'm going to quote you some Frozen 2. There's a really good quote from Frozen 2. Where Olaf, the talking snowman, another character asks him, like, oh, what's that thing you always say? And he gets it wrong a couple times, but the first thing he says is, oh, how advancing technology is going to be both our savior and our destruction. I think, like, yeah, that's kind of, maybe that's also one of the things dystopias and utopias are trying to explore.
Right.
Because these stories are so different. Right, they all fall into this category. They're not only are they all science fiction, but they're all dystopias, and they're all so different. So it's like, what, you know, trying to define like what is a dystopia is very difficult because it's a relatively broad category, and you know, I think that it's part of it being the individual versus the collective, part of it being the expressing the fears of advancing technology. So, change.
Right. So one thing I thought, and this kind of appears in a couple of these. So like when we talked about John Savage being happy when he was making stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a similar scene in Return from the Stars, I think. But there is this, in Zen, there is this idea of kind of living in the moment, right? Mm-hmm. Just kind of being totally present now and not kind of putting everything else out of your mind. And that's the kind of, you know, or what I called it flow state before. So people really enjoy that. That's a state to be, people like to be in. So people who do meditation kind of get there. But it occurs in many different places in literature. And like one other place where I remember it from is actually from War and Peace, which I'm reading it now. But
not yet. I'm reading that revolutionary book first. And then
yeah.
Because well, I can't stop watching Hamilton, so I keep reading things about the Revolutionary War.
War and Peace is one, but there's also seen Anna Karenina, so it's another Tolstoy book, where one of the characters goes out to work with the peasants, just cutting hay with
a scythe.
A scythe, right. Mm-hmm. And he describes basically just him working, just walking down the field and cutting hey, and it's like he gets into this flow state. It's just, you just live in the now. The work that's in front of you is just kind of the thing, and you know, sort of you feel very human. And I think technology sometimes takes that away, right? Mm-hmm. So because it's not particularly efficient to go and have a big field of hay. It's easy to have get a machine and stuff. But, you know, working with your hands and just getting into that state as something that people probably crave. It's like, you know, when you get into some creative kind of endeavor with your writing or something, sometimes you get lost in the process.
Mm-hmm.
And often the technology that we create takes it away, right? Because we're trying to be, you know, more efficient or whatever. Mm-hmm. So like chopping wood, you know, to heat up your house, it could have been one of those tasks where you enjoy the physical process mm-hmm. of chopping wood and just being there and doing it, and then you wind up with something useful.
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree. I mean, I think that I think people really enjoy that kind of thing. I know for myself, I love driving. I love, because I get to listen to music and I can think very well when I'm driving, and particularly thinking about creative things. And the concept to me that probably by the end of my life will be up to self-driving automated cars is kind of annoying, because I like driving.
And well, like, it's just like horses, right? Riding horses. At one time, horsemanship was very important. I recently read biography of Ulysses S. Grant, and mm-hmm. one of the interesting things about him was he was an incredible horseman.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, when he was at, he went to West Point, and he was known for doing horse riding tricks. You know, he was, I mean, and throughout his life, he actually got injured a few times when he fell off a horse, but he always mm-hmm. rode horses and always was excellent at it.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, you've done a little bit of horseback riding, so you know what it's like, you know.
It's terrifying. I don't know who would ever get relaxed and get into a kind of... I'm every time I'm on a horse, I'm panicking. I'm doing it, but I'm panicking.
Well, you're not doing it enough, but...
But, I mean, I think one of the things about technology is, like, yes, it does... It can definitely interrupt those kind of activities. It can also create those kind of activities. I think the number one way I know I get to relax is by playing mm-hmm. video games.
Right.
And that's exactly what video games do. They narrow your world to, you know, you are a blood elf fire mage here in, I forget the name of the one place I used to love in World of Warcraft. But you're here. Here's a set of quests. This is your point A, your point B, your point C. You do these things. You accomplish these tasks, and your brain gives you the good chemical to make you feel happy because you've done it. And for that time, you're not worried about the past or the future or the existential crisis or the meaning of life or any of that kind of stuff. I think reading does the same thing.
Right, and telling stories does the same thing, right? So
mm-hmm.
I've read this book, which I think was a high school book, about a kid, a white kid, who got kidnapped by Indians as a baby.
Mm-hmm.
And he grew up among the Indians in New Jersey. So it was mm-hmm. like... And he talks about, like, in the middle of the winter, where everything was just covered with snow and all they could do was pretty much sit inside their little huts. There was a guy who was old guy who had to be carried around because he couldn't walk, but they would bring him to like a place and he would tell stories, and he could, you know, like tell stories and stories and stories. So
yeah, I mean, I think that's I guess the sort of getting to stability and change too is like, not like stability is no fun, but also change that is too rapid is also no fun.
Right.
People don't like when, you know, they get used to something, like they get used to something like, you know, hearing a story orally, like we had in
mm-hmm.
In Ted Chiang's short story here, and then the change to writing and reading it not being the same.
Right.
And, you know, you could enjoy it in the one version, but not in another version. And certainly that disrupting.
Right. So it's like, you know, people as they live their lives want to have some excitement, but some predictability as well. And it's just the balance
mm-hmm.
between the two. And these stories kind of push it in one way or another.
Like
mm-hmm. with Winston in 1984, he didn't know what was going to happen, because he could have arrested any moment because somebody told him that, you know, ratted on him and something, and he'd go to a ministry of love.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So I guess, the final question we kind of have here is, why do we like dystopian stories, or do we? And why do people keep writing dystopian stories? Because they're scary a lot of times. Do you like dystopias?
I like technological dystopias. I always like to think about what technology what effect technology would have on things. So
mm-hmm.
something like Return from the Stars was interesting. Brave New World was interesting. Something like Handmaid's Tale, it was totally societal kind of a thing. It
mm-hmm.
was very well written and kind of very, you know, just from this one point of view, where you kind of have to puzzle out what's going on, which is kind of interesting, but it's not my favorite.
Mm-hmm.
I like Hunger Games because it's like a cheap story where the hero wins in the end. So.
So, I mean, do you like dystopias that have a more optimistic kind of
feel? I prefer things that are somewhat ambiguous. Like, you know, like I like the Ted Chiang story because it's fun to think about what it means when writing is introduced, right? So it's actually very disruptive technology.
Mm-hmm.
And Return from the Stars is the same thing. You kind of get dropped into a world with all this technology as a person of today, kind of. What would you think?
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, if I was Hal, I would not be kidnapping girls, but because that felt wrong. But some of the other stuff he was doing.
Yeah, I mean, so I think for me, I like dystopias a lot. I always have. I think I tend to like more the social dystopias, like Handmaid's Tale, mm-hmm. 1984. I'm not a big fan of utopias or things that border on utopia. I mean, I like Brave New World and that, like, it's an interesting concept, but it's not, like, one of my favorite books or anything. 1984 is one of my favorite books. And I like, I don't know, I guess I like stories that have...
terrible endings?
That are darker. Well, it's like, you know, I love fantasy and I love, like, the Song of Ice and Fire series, right? And... that's a pretty dark series. Like, particularly you get to books 4 and 5 in that series, and it's like bad things happen a lot. But it's not like bad just for the sake of it to be bad or for it to be shocking. It's mm-hmm. like there's a purpose to it. You know, 1984 is very dark for a purpose. It's telling, right. It's making a point. It has a point to make to you, besides just the part in the middle where Winston sits down and reads the book and tells you his feelings. When the author is like, let me explain my philosophy, that besides that, the book itself, the sadness and the darkness is to a point. And so I do like stuff like that. And I think that one of the reasons I like dystopias is that a lot of science fiction that is like social experiment type science mm-hmm. fiction are dystopias.
Right.
You know?
Do we know any utopias that end up those long lines? Like something with Star Trek other than Star Trek?
Right, and the only interesting thing about Star Trek is that they go elsewhere, right? They don't hang out in their utopia. They leave.
Actually, I was thinking with Star Trek, like Deep Space Nine, they don't leave, they stay in one spot.
Yeah, but none of the issues are caused by Earth, right? So none of the issues are caused by Starfleet. The issues are caused by the Bajorans, the Cardassians, the fact that the Bajorans want to join the nice utopian Starfleet.
Right.
And they're like trying the whole time to join. You know, that's this. It's like their struggle to get to the utopia.
Right. You have to struggle, otherwise it's boring.
I don't want to read about like how lovely Harry Kim's life was before he went on Voyager. You know, like, okay, it was lovely, I'm sure.
Maybe that's the attraction of these books. You know, we want our lives to be nice and boring and pleasant, mm-hmm. but we want to imagine what would I do if I was Katniss?
Oh yeah, I think that's one of the things about science fiction generally. That's so interesting is like, you know, by virtue of reading a story about characters, you think to yourself, well, what would I do?
Right.
You know, you think about, I think Omalas is actually probably the best example because Omalas specifically puts to the reader, you know, people that live here have to make a choice to stay and know this or to leave. Right. And so it kind of automatically gives you the choice. And it's like upsetting how many of us would stay because a lot of us would.
Would you stay or would you leave? People.
I don't know.
I would have left.
If my family was there, I probably would have stayed.
Mm.
If I can get my whole family to go, I would go. But yeah, it's I think it's really interesting. So, I guess people keep writing them because they sell very well. So, the reason. Okay, so I think we've hit them on pretty much everything with the dystopias that we've read.
Well, so what's next? What are we going to do next? What's our project? So,
our next set of readings is going to be long books.
I was saying the theme would be, you know, classics or something.
Right, and so the next one's going to be Dune, right?
Right.
So I've read Dune before, but I read it back, oh my gosh, I was like 13 when I read Dune.
Yeah, I've read Dune before as well.
And there's going to be a new movie, right? There's like a new Dune movie that's in production.
It's supposed to be out in December, so hopefully we can have the podcast out before then.
Yes. Yeah, so we're gonna do classic. So we'll do Dune. Have we picked any other ones?
No.
I think we were talking about Foundation, but I don't know if we actually want to reread Foundation.
Nah, I don't want to read Foundation.
Yeah. I don't like Foundation.
No, maybe
we could do iRobot.
Those are pretty good stories. Maybe we should do some Heinlein. Mm-hmm. He's got a couple of short books that are kind of political. To kind of, like Moon is a Harsh Mistress.
Yeah.
Or Strange in a Strange Land is another classic.
Ooh, yes.
Have you read that?
Some of those. No, I haven't read either of them, but I know them.
Okay.
I know of them. So, yeah, so our next one will be Dune. Dune's a long book, so I don't know if you and I kind of talked about maybe doing two podcasts for it, or we weren't sure.
Let's see how it goes, yeah.
Yeah. So we'll figure it out. But that's it for Dystopias. So thank you, everyone, for joining us. And we'll see you next time.
No, I just have some comment for the outtake, maybe.
Okay. You want to record the outtake on purpose? Go for it.
Yeah, so remember one of the interesting points in Truth the Factor of Feeling was about words. When Gingy was learning to write, he wrote everything just squished together.
Mm-hmm.
And then the missionary.
Missionary, yeah.
Missionary told him you have to space the words out because he didn't understand what words were. Right. So I was listening to another podcast, and they were talking to the author of a book called The Shallows, which is a book about internet influence on a culture. So I have to read it. But one of the things he talked about, a little bit about, you know, compared introduction of internet to introduction of writing.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, you know, initially, people, when they wrote it to be read out loud.
Mm-hmm.
So all the symbols were just strung together without any spaces.
Mm-hmm.
It's only when people started to read silently to themselves, that's when they started adding the spaces, according to him.
Huh.
And he actually had a quote from St. Augustine, who makes some comments about some bishop who said he reads so well because he would read to himself quietly. Mm-hmm. And he makes the same point, you know, the guy was saying, you know, when you speak, we don't do any, you can't tell where the words start or end. It's kind of slightly arbitrary. So I actually went on the internet and looked at some photos of old books like Greek and Sumerian and stuff. And he was right. There is no spaces. And
yeah.
You told me in Japanese, there is no spaces between words either.
Yeah, normally in Japanese, there isn't. It's actually interesting because there can be. And I think that's a Western influence thing, because you don't have to write Japanese with any spaces.
Right.
So, like, if you look at, like, if you were in Japan and you look at, like, signs for stuff, for example, a lot of times there are just no spaces. Whereas if you look in, like, you know, the Japanese books that we learned from when I was in college, the sentences would have spaces within the book, like, within the textbook, but then when we did like tests and things like that, our teacher, like, she always wrote on the board, just no spaces, and we could write with no spaces, and that's really how it was supposed to be.
Interesting.
So. Yeah.
So yeah. Cool. So words are not that obvious.
No, I mean that makes sense. I mean, how are you supposed to tell when someone's just talking to you where a word begins and ends? It's just sound.
Right.